Welcome to Morning Mental Health. I'm Nate, and today we have Dr. Jennifer Olson. She can tell you more about herself.
Yeah, good morning. I'm Dr. Jennifer Olson, and I'm a board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist here in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay, so starting with our first question. So as a psychiatrist, what is like the most common mental health symptoms that you see per day within patients?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, so I generally work in the outpatient setting with kids and adolescents and young adults. I see the whole spectrum. We see a lot of depression, anxiety, ADHD. We're seeing a lot of kiddos with various degrees of autism. And then it even goes to the extreme of people who have bipolar, even as children. So it's really just the entire gamut of common things that happen with kids and adolescents.
Yeah, so you basically are getting just kind of one of everything, just kind of one of every flavor.
It's a mixed bag. You know, it definitely, rarely do I see somebody who has just one thing going on, but that also does happen. Oftentimes I'll see people who have ADHD and anxiety and depression because they often feed into each other and stress people out.
Yeah. So going off of that, what kind of do certain mental illnesses tend to come along with other mental illnesses? Like you talked about, anxiety comes with ADHD.
Yeah, actually, we definitely have shown through research that a lot of them can be co-occurring. So if you are diagnosed with one, you have a higher chance of maybe having some other ones going on, and it depends on what it is. And also a lot of mental health things, you know, we talk about nature versus nurture. We do know a lot of them are genetic. So we look at family trees and what's been going on with parents, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles. We kind of want to get a whole history so we can see genetically what somebody might be more predisposed to have.
Yeah. Okay. So another question that I had is, what do you personally think is kind of the reason for such a huge uprising of mental illness diagnosis in like during COVID?
Yeah. Well, and it's been really interesting. COVID has totally thrown out the playbook on what we do and see, because oftentimes when I get people in, my job is really the medications, if they're appropriate, if they're not appropriate, and generally in combination with like therapy, good self-care, so getting enough sleep, exercise, eating correctly, having good social contacts. So in COVID, it got really interesting because people who maybe had depression or anxiety but had it well controlled because they had the structure of school, they had friends to hang out with, resources in the community were available, people who had 504s or IEPs at school to have some accommodations. A lot of those we couldn't provide during a pandemic because they required somebody to be with the student. And so COVID has been really interesting because I don't necessarily think that it increased the number of people who had these diagnoses. I think it really just brought out people who were maybe just doing better because they had their own routines and structure and things that were supporting them. And then those got removed. The other thing that is really interesting about COVID and the pandemic is that generally people in their life will have an event that throws them off. So a family member dying, a pet dying, moving, things like that where their whole life is kind of out of sorts. And what we saw with the pandemic was the whole world was out of sorts. So when one person has something going on in their life, generally we can rely on the support structure to still be there. And those people available and not super stressed, during the pandemic, we saw a lot of those resources not available and everybody under increased stress.
So it kind of everybody kind of already had the actual like mental illness, but we didn't really detect it until after, you know, everything was like the world kind of was shook up a bunch and they didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting when we talk about mental illness and mental health. One thing is it's not a problem until it's a problem. Like you can be kind of more depressed than your normal student or kid. You may have more anxiety. But until it's a problem, we don't diagnose it. So generally by the time I see people, they're having school avoidance. I see a lot of people that come in that have gone through all sorts of specialists because they've had stomach issues. They've had weird neurological things, lots of migraines, things like that. And so often they haven't found a medical cause. And so I really get people where we talk a lot about the brain-body connection. And it's huge, especially for GI issues. And once the GI doctors have looked and said, hey, we don't see anything wrong with that system, then I get to see them and say, look, they're not saying it's all in your head. But in many ways, it's all in your head. But it doesn't mean you're making it up, because really that serotonin connection, especially between your gut and your brain, causes things like stomach upset, diarrhea, constipation, just nausea, vomiting. It causes all the things. And so that's just been really another point to make to people, is there's nothing necessarily wrong with you. This is just how your brain is functioning. And it may need some help with things like a little more serotonin or dopamine or norepinephrine. And medications can sometimes help, but we also want to make sure that we have a lot of the social structure and good self-care in place as well. So, I mean, probably to answer your question, I think it has worsened what was already there. I don't think it necessarily caused more.
Yeah. Okay. That. So another question is, for people who do not necessarily like need medication for mental illnesses, if it hasn't gotten to that point, what are some like really good tools for different, like the differences and some really good tools for mental illnesses?
Yeah. So people in general, I mean, when I see people, they've already maybe tried a lot of these things, or we have the discussion about, hey, we don't need to necessarily start meds. They're a tool that work for some people. But we always talk about sleep hygiene. So that's probably the, well, it's one of the two least favorite conversations that I have with teenagers, especially sleep. Oh, who doesn't love some good sleep? But in order to have a good sleep cycle, we recommend that people go to bed every time at night, including weekends, holidays, waking up at the same time in the morning, including weekends and holidays, not doing anything in bed except for sleep. So if you're doing homework, if you're talking on the phone, if you're watching YouTube, doing Snapchat, Instagram, watching, I don't know, take your pick of whatever, then your brain's going to say, hey, this bed is where I do fun things, where I'm going to be or homework. It doesn't associate it with sleep. So we want your brain to be conditioned that once you lay down in that bed, we're sleeping. That's it. And then if you don't fall asleep in about 15 minutes, we want you to get up and do something boring. So the definition of boring for adults and kids is much different. So adults, we don't want them going and paying bills, which is pretty boring, but it's productive. We don't want you going and like folding laundry. Flip side for kids, I think a great strategy for some of the younger ones has been, here's a pile of socks. Start pairing them a little bit. Kids will go to sleep real quick to avoid having to match socks. And then also, you know, not exercising too close to bedtime, not eating too close to bedtime, watching the caffeine intake, which is super fun, especially with teenagers.
For sure.
Yeah. And then having an environment that promotes sleep. So having a comfortable bed, having the room cool and dark, and then being able to kind of snuggle under blankets, it kind of helps your brain to say, oh, okay, it's dark. We're supposed to go to sleep.
Yeah. So what you're kind of saying is that bed should specifically and only be for sleeping in and nothing else pretty much.
Nothing else for adolescents. Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, for sure. So kind of on the topic of some of the earlier questions with like the toddlers and, you know, how you can't really tell.
Yeah.
What the difference between manic and like just super energized toddlers. Because I know I have a lot of very younger cousins that I deal with all the time. And they are definitely very energetic. So the question was, is how young do you typically like are okay with diagnosing somebody?
Yeah, no, that's a really excellent question. So I do know, especially going to conferences and in my training, that we do go down to preschool. And interestingly enough, there are certain things that really have to have symptoms before a certain age in order for us to diagnose. So autism is an excellent example. Autism, we generally see symptoms before the age of 3. Now, that's not to say we're going to diagnose a kid as autistic at that age. And as we keep going, the gap between kind of what their abilities are and what their growth is in certain social and verbal areas starts becoming more apparent compared to normal. So there are some people that, behavioral pediatricians, some of those that see younger kids. There's also some child psychiatrists that specialize in preschoolers. Me, not so much. So I will take the history from that. I want to say the youngest kiddo I have probably diagnosed as straight up ADHD was 4. And that would have to be a pretty extreme case. I've actually had a few that at the age of four, we went ahead and said, yeah, this is going to be an issue. Generally, I see them when they're going to be kicked out of daycare or when we're really struggling with potty training because they just can't slow down enough to focus on their body and listen to the cues. Or they're doing really dangerous things. So they're so impulsive, they're, you know, running across the street without thinking about it. They're jumping off of things. They're maybe have younger siblings and they think they're playing, but they're too rough. They can't really control their bodies. And so when it starts becoming kind of a safety issue or they're going to get kicked out of school, then we definitely look and say, okay, what is maybe going on and how can we either do behavioral strategies or maybe look at medications?
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely like, yeah. So depending on, it's kind of more depending on the person and how many characteristics of like, you know, the mental illness that they're showing.
Yeah. Or how it's impacting their life. Really, by the time they come to me, something's going on. They may have met criteria for a diagnosis for years, but it's finally gotten to a point where this is negatively impacting my life. ADHD, especially for people who are pretty smart and have a lot of structure in their life, you may have had it since you were young, but you were able to work around it. I remember in medical school, they said, we even have people that get diagnosed at that point because they were good enough at structuring stuff and they were smart enough to work around it where they were able to do that up until it finally hit a brick wall of, you know, college, graduate school, medical school. But I'm also seeing, you know, middle school, high school. It doesn't mean you're not smart. It just means the level of ADHD and your ability to work around it, it's finally overwhelmed.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So moving kind of forward in life, so away from like toddlers and preschoolers. So I know that there's been a lot of self-diagnosing, especially off of social media platforms like TikTok and everything like that. And I know that you definitely have talked a lot about just kind of in personal life, just all of the negative effects of that. So I wanted you to kind of like tell our listeners just more about the negative effects of, you know, self-diagnosing off of social media platforms, especially, and even just looking it up.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And something, as I talk to my colleagues, we are definitely seeing an uptick in especially adolescents and kind of later teenagers. TikTok, great platform for many things, not so great for others. And so we've actually been seeing an uptick in people who come in and say, I think I have autism, or come in and say, I think I have borderline personality disorder, or come in and say, I think I have ADHD, or they'll develop kind of a new tic, like a motor movement that they feel they don't have control over. And when we start really asking like, okay, why do you feel like suddenly this is something that you might have? We hear like, okay, I follow some people on TikTok, or I looked at YouTube, or people on Instagram are posting stories. And it's a really interesting thing where as humans, we have a lot of empathy and compassion. And in some ways, we kind of absorb the energy of other people. And so, yeah, we'll have to talk about it and say, okay, like, let's go through the criteria. Let's go through what would be some treatments for each of these things. And especially if it's kind of new and it doesn't fit with what was going on before, we say, let's just monitor that. But man, oh man, Dr. Google did not get a medical degree. I don't advise Googling anything without knowing what you're getting into. So I was actually thinking about this. This is a really great reason for in high school and middle school, when you're doing a research paper and they say, don't just Google it. You need to go to a reputable source that knows what they're talking about. Great. If you can use it in a scholarly way and find resources. So the NAMI website, NIH, several of those things can have good resources and places for you to go look. But if you Google anything, it's basically going to say, that med's going to kill you. You probably have this horrible, horrible disease, and good luck.
Yeah. Yeah. Google does tend to give you kind of like the worst of everything in all these cases that are like maybe one in like a million or something. Yeah. I've seen some very weird, you know, just Google searches on different mental illnesses, and it's very strange just
yeah.
with all that sort of stuff.
It is, and it's, you know, the other interesting thing is there's not enough psychiatrists. There's not enough mental health professionals out there to be able to really do the diagnosis. And so if you don't already have a psychiatrist or a therapist or somebody who's really in tune to kind of mental health issues and what's normal and what's maybe not so normal, pediatricians are going to be your first line. They see probably more kids that have mental health issues than even I do because they're seeing everybody. And so they generally are working with kiddos who maybe have some anxiety, but it's not to the point that they can't leave the house. Maybe some depression, because those are pretty normal things to have when you're an adolescent.
Yeah. So with mental illnesses, I know that they definitely have a spectrum for each one, depending on how, like, you know, how bad it is. So kind of at what point on that spectrum is it moving away from, you know, like really good tools in order to be able to deal with it to like medicating somebody for it, just to help with it?
Yeah. Well, and it's just, it depends on what impact it's having on their life. I absolutely have people who have ADHD. We know they have ADHD. It might be affecting their work. But medications, as much as they can help, they also have downsides. They have potential for side effects. They may, you know, in ADHD, if you have ADHD and anxiety, we may use a stimulant, and that may actually help the anxiety because you're able to put the filter in and kind of, you know, life isn't coming at you as fast. But it might also make the anxiety side worse because we're now kind of messing with your dopamine system a bit. So when we have the discussion about are meds going to be a good choice, we look at what we're specifically treating, what symptoms are there. I also want to know, like, do other people in your family have these things going on? What have they tried? What's worked? What really has not worked? Because we'll probably avoid those things because genetically, if your parent did super unwell on a certain kind of medication, that's not going to be where I'm going to start with you. I'm going to try probably what's worked for other family members. And also, I mean, I prefer kids to not be on meds. Who wants kids on meds? Nobody. By the time they come and see me, we've already tried no meds. And then for a lot of things, we say, okay, let's try looking at some meds. And then we want like a year of stability. I want people to have their brains calm and be like, okay, this is how it's supposed to be. And then we talk about trying to take meds off. But there are some things that, you know, you just might need to be on meds for quite a while because your particular biology, you may be lacking in something. So like somebody who has diabetes needs insulin. Their pancreas is no longer creating insulin. Same with depression, anxiety. Maybe your brain just isn't making enough serotonin. And so we have to kind of maybe use medication to get you up to what would be considered a, quote, normal level.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, we are kind of running out of time here. So last question I was just going to wrap it up with would be, so with medications, I know like different medications for different mental illnesses, those conflict a lot. I do know that bit.
Yeah.
So conflicting like medications and stuff, like what do you have to do with that in normal life?
Yeah, actually that's really interesting because we have people that in some ways like take their dopamine system, you know, that can be off when you have huge mood dysregulation. It can also be off when you have ADHD. And so people can definitely have both of those things. So we do have to look at the medications and make sure that we are taking into account the different receptors and what we're doing to them. Are we increasing the amount? Are we decreasing the amount? Are we blocking certain parts so that your body naturally is then making a little bit more? So we do have to look at meds. And then we also have to look at what over-the-counter medications people are taking. So allergy meds, birth control, other medications for other illnesses they may have, and make sure that those aren't conflicting. And often we'll be working also with a pharmacist if we really, you know, new meds come out all the time. So we need to check and make sure, because they have a little more training in just the broad area of medications, they can help us figure out if there's going to be any specific interactions that we would not want.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.